We're under orders here when we teach classes to introduce ourselves. This is for really two reasons. Number one, so you don't go through the whole class saying, who is he? Or who does he think? Well, you'll say that anyway. What does he think he is? But secondly, it's a way to let the taping people know that it's time to start. So I'm Dan Erlander is my name. I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I'm serving here at Holden for 1 year as a village pastor. And one part of my responsibilities here is occasionally teaching. So this is one of those fun opportunities. During this week, and this is very intentional because maybe not all of you knew it when you came this week that it's Christmas week. Did you all know that? That you will be treated on Friday to July 25, Christmas in July. And we thought it would be a wonderful way to surround that day to actually have a Bible study on the Christmas narratives. And so today and tomorrow we'll look at Matthew's Christmas narratives or his birth or infancy narratives. And then Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday we'll look at Luke. And I have this time, so on Christmas Day we'll study Luke 2, 1 through 20. Has anybody ever read that? And okay. So it'll be time to hit that right on our Christmas in July day. And then Saturday I'd like to have almost no structure for myself on that day, just a chance for us to reflect on what we have learned during the week. I'd be interested to start, just has anybody ever studied the Christmas stories as a Bible study? One or two. Yeah, and that's why I think this is exciting, because it's really for Bible study, it's breaking new ground. Because we've almost always had the assumption that these stories are kind of the sentimental and also very beautiful stories that we read at Christmas time. We read them and they bring back a lot of memories. They bring a lot of the feeling of Christmas. We love Luke is a master storyteller. We love these stories. But it's almost never that we actually look at these stories as Bible studies. So we're going to look at these stories these days exactly like we would study any other book or any part of the Bible. And I realize that part of the fun of this and also part of the threat is that we all have a lot of assumptions about these stories and a lot of attachments. And so I'm expecting and I hope there'll both be joy and some tension as we move into these stories. And then I always like to say my first 5 minutes what my goal is for the week. And several weeks ago when we studied Revelation, I only had one goal, and that was to teach people to say Revelation instead of Revelations. So I don't have really high goals. But I think my goal for this week would be when we celebrate Christmas story on Friday, that it will have a little deeper and a little more mature meaning for you. And then as you celebrate the traditional time for Christmas, which as you know is December 25th, that these stories will be alive for you in a new way because of studying. I could warn you that the studies these weeks will have some difficult times or some parts that are hard. And it'll be amazing to you how complicated these simple stories are, and how Matthew and Luke have level after level of meaning that's weaving in and out of these old stories. So right now I just want to plunge right in. Are you ready? Okay. And about both stories, just as a matter of how these stories came to be, the first point, the Gospels are written backwards. And just to explain that, the earliest material we have in the New Testament would be about what part... I just have to get down here. Some night I'm going to sneak in and tear this thing down. What part of the story of the life of Jesus was told first, do you think? By the church in its preaching. Right. Yeah, the death and resurrection. And then most likely those who heard and believed ask more and more questions from those who had been with Jesus. Okay, now you've proclaimed the good news of the death and resurrection. What did he do and what did he say? So what would be the second part of the gospel? Yeah, right, the ministry teachings and ministry. Okay, what one of the four gospels only has those parts? Yeah, John, right, starts with whom? What character does the book of John's? John the Baptist. And also, what other book begins with John? Yeah, right. So Mark, or let's just think of the three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke here, that Mark now starts here with John the Baptist. Okay, now the next question, and Mark, I'll be referring to this off and on during the whole week, but Mark was written about 75, unless someone who has studied has any, that's always changing, you know, one. If you go to seminary one year, it's 75, and if you go to seminary next year, it's 76 or 74. Or sometimes there's other theories that it's very different, but about 75. Okay, then those who believe in the death and resurrection, and they have learned the teaching and the ministry of Jesus, they've learned to love Jesus, then the next question you would naturally ask is what? These things are obvious. Where did he come from? What was he like as a baby? And have you ever thought of that with a famous person? You know, just what was he like as a kid? You know, so that's why then the next writers now answer these questions about the infancy. And that would be Luke and Matthew. Again, these dates could be a little different, but Matthew maybe 85, Luke about 90. So do you see that point then, how the Gospels were really written backwards? So the earliest material we have is the material about the preaching of the death and resurrection, and then the infancy narratives. Okay, now where I'd like to... where I would like to move now is into the book of Matthew and into its context. And the way I like to do Bible study, and it's the way I think Bible study should be done, is that we are never ready to ask the question, what does this mean for us, until we've really worked at understanding to whom was this written, what was their situation, how did they hear it, what did they need to hear, and all kinds of questions about them. And by them, I mean the people that lived in about 85 that first read the book of Matthew and to whom the book of Matthew was written. And after we've understood that, then it's natural to ask the question, now what does this mean for us? So I want to go back there. Part of the reason I like Bible study this way, I'm a gossip. I don't know if any of you are. But aren't you just curious about people? You know, you like to know what the neighbors are doing and the other people in your church and the pastor and his family and what they're up to. And, doesn't it just also naturally enter your mind, what were these people thinking and doing that were first reading the book of Matthew? Do you ever think of that when you read the Bible? You know, really for Bible study to come alive, it means to become biblical gossips, kind of, you know what I mean? To really say, I want to know them, I want to know what they're doing. So I want to give a little background and then in a little dramatic way help you feel what it might have been. First, but before I do that, the main source book I'm using for these 5 days is Raymond Brown's Birth of the Messiah. And this is a massive 500-page commentary on 5 chapters in the New Testament, so it's there is not one little detail about the birth narratives that it wouldn't be in this book. And it's available in the bookstore. It doesn't read like a comic book. I mean, it's a kind of book that is meant to be a book that you use for very deep Bible study. And so if you're looking for like a novel or something, it wouldn't be the book to get. But if you want to really move, and what we'll be covering in this, in these 5 or 6 days, I'll try to hit the major themes that Raymond Brown brings out. Yeah. And Raymond Brown, it's Union, right? Raymond Brown is a Roman Catholic New Testament scholar, and he teaches at Union Theological Seminary in New York. And Janet just told me her husband is studying under Raymond. Do you have any gossip about him this week? Okay, if you want to fill in. But he's a good teacher.
Oh, yes.
He's
fantastic.
Fantastic teacher. So. And you sense that when you read his books. Okay. Now, if we're thinking about Matthew written about 85, we're talking about 55 years after the crucifixion. And part of it, you have to get a sense now of time. If some of you are 60, you can remember 50 years ago. And you realize, think of all that's happened. Is anybody here 60? Okay. It's a volunteer. I mean, imagine how long it would take if we would say, well, just stand up and tell us about your last 50 years. We won't ask you now.
Please.
You know, all you're asking, not. Okay. But just imagine, you know, you'd share your joys and sorrows, changes, ups and downs, passages, you know, how, and all the history that's happened that's affected your life in the last 50 years. And I think that helps us see that all of a sudden, it wasn't Jesus alive, Jesus dies, Jesus rises again, and everybody gets their pencils out. But the book of Matthew now is 50 years of a community and a people struggling and asking questions and saying, what does this mean? And they live in traumas, and they live in persecution, and they live in questions that bring terrible doubts upon them. The biggest, you know, for most of us, if we live 50 years, you could maybe say the historical event that had the greatest impact on your life. You know, for someone younger, like someone about 30, it might be Vietnam, or someone in their 30s. You know, the biggest world event that had an impact on your life. There'd be no question that the first readers of the book of Matthew, the biggest impact on their life would be the destruction of Jerusalem. The total destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD. And we'll refer to that, back to that again. So where we're going to start is a long ways from Christmas, from the manger and the little house in Bethlehem. But I promise you we'll get back to that. Okay, it might be Saturday morning, but we will. Since you're closest, that you get, that's your punishment. Since you're closest, I'm going to pretend like you're a Christian. I mean, you
are. I'm going to finish this.
I pretend like you're a Christian in about the year 85. Finish my sentence. Okay, the situation, it's probably a Christian congregation somewhere in Palestine or near Palestine in the 80s. At the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the very rigid Jewish Christian community really fled and has relocated way east. So you have now is little Christian congregations that are made up of Jewish Christians and Gentile converts. Okay, they live then in little towns, and they're surrounded by Jewish neighbors who are faithful to the law. And so in these little towns, you'll have Jewish people who are Christians who are meeting with Gentiles, worshiping together. And then you'll have Jewish Christians who have, Jewish people who have not accepted Jesus as the Messiah. And through the years now, the tension between these two groups and the alienation is mounting until it reaches the climax at the Jewish Council of Jamnia in 90, when all Jewish Christians are excommunicated from the synagogue and declared no longer part of the people of Israel. So we're still just a few years before the excommunication, so the question has not been settled yet. So, and just before a question is settled, the alienation mounts. So I'm going to be a Jewish person that has not accepted Jesus as the Messiah, and I'm going to try to talk you out of your foolish decision. Okay. And you can respond if you like to. You don't have to. Anyway, I've heard that you have become a Christian, and I really think that's awful. And I want to give you really three reasons. Can you hear me? When I get conversational, I don't talk very loud. But first, I don't know if you understand, but you have left the faith of the ancestors, and you have joined a heretical sect that is worse than the Samaritans. It is worse than the Samaritans. The reason it's worse than the Samaritans is that you are taking Gentile people and you are actually eating with them and worshiping with them. And what they are doing is they're bringing Greek ideas into Judaism. And I don't know if you remember, but our ancestors died on the battlefields in the Maccabean Wars to preserve Judaism from being infiltrated by Greek thinking. You have left the faith, you have left the religion, you have cut yourself off from Israel, you have cut yourself off from Abraham, and you have become really worse than the Samaritans. And I'm very, very upset. Now, I want to ask you some questions about the person you say is the Messiah. Jesus fulfilled nothing that's in the Old Testament dreams and expectations of the Messiah. For when the Messiah comes, there will be the Messianic Age. There will be the Age of Peace. Jerusalem will shine as a jewel and the sunshine of all the nations, and all the nations will come to her light. That is the promise of the Messianic Age. What happened when Jesus came is that Jerusalem was destroyed. You can walk down south and see where it was. It's a heap of rubble. All you'll see is a bunch of stones. And you say the Messianic Age has come. That is utter foolishness. Then another thing, I've heard this story that you have told about Jesus being born and his mother being a virgin. Now, I want to ask you if there's anything in the expectation in the Old Testament prophets of Jesus or the Messiah being born to a virgin. This is ridiculous. And what we think is that he was an illegitimate child, and God would never, never choose an illegitimate child to be the Messiah. And if you had any sense about you, you would just quit and come back to us. Well, how do you, I don't think I can do it with the, I wish I could add to it more of the intensity of the feeling and the emotion. This is really we're so many years removed from this argument, but I wanted to say that to help you feel a little what these Christians were experiencing. And
the arguments are really overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
If you could imagine that kind of thing going on day after day, year after mm-hmm. year, with all kinds of different people involved in it, it's quite overwhelming. and you would have to be into erected defense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two arguments I forgot I was going to include that were very strong arguments. One was the argument that how could Jesus be the Messiah if the vast majority of the Jewish people didn't accept him? It's only this weird little group of people. And secondly, how could Jesus be the Messiah if he was killed or executed by the Romans as an insurrectionist? You know, there's nothing in our scriptures to prepare us for that. You know, it was even worse than kind of having a logical argument. Not only was there a logical argument against you, but there was also an accusation of foolishness. You know, and all of us can kind of take logical arguments because we can come back, but when somebody just says we're dumb, how do you feel?
That's usually where negative arguments start with, because you're dumb. Mm-hmm.
You know, typical children's argument, you know, are you ever dumb?
You know. Those that kept the faith then must have been very, very strong in their faith, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In their conviction that Jesus was the Christ,
mm-hmm.
Because it would seem like the pressure would be very, very great to persuade you.
Yeah, and I hope you felt that the pressure, if you were a Jewish person especially, the pressure from your Jewish friends and your Jewish business associates, the people you met at the well, at the market, the pressure was tremendous because they had really good arguments. Yeah, so if you have to feel that now before we can really move into Matthew's birth narratives.
Not just the pressure from friends, but it must have been the internal pressures from years and years of this culture and your family background, and they must have had some tremendous personal conflict.
Mm-hmm.
They were also disinherited, weren't they, too, so it was an economic.
Yeah, officially they weren't until like 5 years later, per se, but it's coming.
Some families undoubtedly cut them off at the pocket, so to speak. Yeah.
It's coming closer. It's a families, you know, it's a family squabble. The closest thing we've seen in the last years is the Missouri Synod. But that doesn't quite, but when we laugh a little, but when you know the emotional intensity and the broken hearts in the Missouri Synod, you might get a little idea. Elmer could probably tell us plenty about it. Could be here at Holden.
What about the family struggles that are going on among the people who have children who are joining
in? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would, because the Jewish people that did not accept Jesus as Messiah, they weren't bad people. You know, they were being faithful to Abraham and to the faith of their fathers. And if anything you had learned over the last generations was, the biggest threat to the faith is assimilation. You know, and Greek rulers had tried that, and thousands had died. You know, every family had someone in their ancestry that given his life on the battlefields to keep from happening exactly what was happening in these congregations of Jewish and Gentile people really assimilating. And they're allowing Gentile people in without demanding that they accept Jewish dietary laws, ritual laws, feast days, and circumcision. So if you start to get a little feeling, and the other important thing before we move into this, you see what we have set up here is a Christian really reaction to Jewish persecution. And the danger of this is to just picking this up and applying it to our day without looking at everything that's gone on in between, and then letting that feed our anti-Semitism today. And we have to really guard against that when we read a book of Matthew, even more when we read the book of John that's always talking about the Jews. And I just finished reading Potok's beautiful history of the Jewish people called Wanderings. And I think every Christian should read a book like that to see how the Jewish people through centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries have been slaughtered by Christians, martyred by Christians, persecuted by Christians, moved out of from country to country by Christians. And the Jewish people know this history. They know it well, of how when the people were not persecuting Jews enough, the priests and others in the church tried to get them to persecute the Jews more. When the church tried to stop people from persecuting Jews, then the people in the churches did it anyway. And the Jews, through the centuries in Europe, had no place to go, no place to run. And it's just back and forth, slaughter, dying by Christians. And this history has been hidden from most of us. I mean, how many in your Christian education and upbringing really heard about centuries and centuries and centuries of Christian slaughter of Jews?
Do you mean Christian nations, or do you mean Christian groups?
Christian people officially in the name of Jesus Christ. You know, this, it's a part of our history that we need to face and face it squarely. Because it's not just one century in the history of the Christian church, but it's almost every century.
Well, the church taught it as a virtue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And officially, it didn't end until the Second Vatican Council. Yeah.
I guess I would say that it probably has not yet ended, because I have borrowed a book, but I can't read it that often because it gets me angry. But the hoax of the 20th century, mm-hmm. you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I'm trying to say that the Holocaust never happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Trying to prove.
Mm-hmm. Another good book, just to get a sense of this, is to read The Source. I think every Christian should, and it would help. It would help us realize the cheapness of just running up to a Jew and say, "Why don't you accept Jesus?" You know, for them, Jesus is the one in whose name their ancestors have been slaughtered for centuries, and for us to just walk up and say, "Hey, Jesus is the Messiah," you know, is... First of all, we should spend 100 years on our knees before Jewish people repenting. And then maybe after a couple 100 years, we'll have a little credibility.
Because we're doing the same thing that they did, with chauvinism. Uh-huh. In their own history, the precedent for persecuting the one who claims a higher virtue than the people around him. Joseph was persecuted by his brothers because he stood out, and the Jewish people have always said, "We are the chosen people. We have something distinct, and it's human nature to kick the guy in the face who claims he's better than you are."
We never deny.
So then we go ahead and do the same thing, of course.
I think it's always the important thing is always it's much easier to face somebody else's than our own history. You know, and that's I felt it necessary to bring this in before we enter Matthew, where there's a lot of kind of anti-official Jewish. And you'll find in the book of Matthew this intense sense that we are the true Israel. You know, and you have to really counter that with Paul's writings in Romans, who says really, for some mysterious reason, there's two covenant people. God is so faithful to his promise to Israel that even if they reject Jesus, he's going to run the world with two covenant people, not one, two. And that's where Paul finally says the depth of the wisdom and knowledge, how unsearchable are his. You know, why would a God have two? Yeah, so, well, we'll move on now to... Okay, what I want to write down Matthew's really two purposes now. But on the outline here, what we call the first two chapters, the infancy narratives, are really the Gospel of Matthew in miniature. And I'll get to the outline in a minute, but the Matthew's task is really twofold, especially in the infancy narratives. One is to defend the inclusion of Gentiles. Here's my writing. Defend the inclusion of Gentiles, and then to teach that Jesus is the true continuation of Israel. Now, the reason I started where I did was so when you saw these 2 points, they just don't look academic. These are the 2 points that Christian people wept over at night because those were the 2 points that were confusing them so much. These are the 2 points that Christians in Palestine in these congregations that were both Jewish and Gentile thought many times about dropping the Christian church and the Christian faith because of these. If you can start to see that, like, a book of Matthew is not, oh, I think I'll sit down and write a book, but it is intense questions of doubt and frustration and confusion and people crying for help on these points that are really tearing their lives apart. Now, what I'll do these first 2 days is today we'll look at this one and then teaching that Jesus is a true continuation of Israel, and then tomorrow we'll look at this one. And the way Matthew does this now with the Christmas stories is just fascinating, and I hope I can communicate some of my excitement about it. And I always have to tell that I'm Swedish, and when I'm really excited, I'm about like this. So get ready. So get ready for that. Sometimes I think I should put up a finger or something. I'm now excited. Let's review the story. If you want to open your Bibles to Matthew 1, let's get this Matthew's infancy story in our mind. And then where does he start? Matthew 1. Yeah, the genealogies. The genealogies are when people say, I think I'll read the Bible. And then they start with the first page of the New Testament. They say, isn't this exciting? Yeah, so he starts with the genealogy, and then the second part, this son, I know in the back you can't see this, but then the next part then after the genealogies is the virginal conception of Jesus. The obedient response of Joseph, you know, when he finds out the news that his that Mary is pregnant of the Holy Spirit, he obeys the directive of God, and then the birth of Jesus. And then in Matthew, then in chapter 2, the wise men come from the east. Now, one thing we really do wrong at Christmas time, and we're going to do the same wrong thing on Friday, is that we mix Luke and Matthew at the manger. Do you ever notice that? There are two completely separate stories with separate meanings. Even if you struggle with the historicity, you realize that any wise men would have never made it to the manger. They were in a house later. But still, we mix these two, and part of being an adult now is to kind of separate. Okay, the wise men come, the wise men pay homage, then Herod, they go back by another way because Herod wants to come and worship the child, but they're warned in a dream. And then Joseph is warned, so we have the flight to Egypt, and then Herod's massacre of the innocents. And then after Herod dies, and right here I have the time chart, and Herod the Great is 37 B.C. to 4 A.D. So at this point, when Herod dies, then the return to Nazareth. So that's just a brief brief outline. Then the outline, too, is it's when we call Matthew's Christmas account the Gospel of Matthew in miniature, it's the same point as made in these two chapters is made in the whole book. The good news, and then from that good news is a twofold response. Some people accept it and some people reject it. And now, if you can already see how Matthew is going to finally answer the doubts of the people, it is this way. Here's the gospel, here's the good news. Some people accept it, some people reject it. What will you do? So at the end, it's not a rational argument that Matthew will end up with. He'll end up with the gospel and then stories about some people that take it and some people that leave it. And then leaves it kind of in the lap of the reader. Here it is, take it or leave it. So he has that in miniature now in the first two chapters. Now, I want to now move into how Matthew in the story, and what I'm going to do is just try to push this into 10 minutes now and just blah, 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 blah. And then I hope then we can have 10 minutes before the bell rings just to respond. Okay, the first problem Matthew has is that, as we heard in the argument, that Jesus is so out of line with messianic expectations that Matthew has to show that Jesus really is a totally new thing. And at the same time, while Jesus coming is a totally new creation or a new thing, he is also in continuity with the line of Israel. So the second point in continuity, Matthew begins with the genealogy. And unlike Luke, where does the genealogy start? With Abraham. Jesus goes back to Abraham. And then the line of Jesus goes through which great, great, great person, who is the King David. And then Joseph, by adopting Jesus, and Matthew has to make a little jump here, Joseph, by adopting Jesus, gives to Jesus the line of the family of David. So Matthew now through this has established that Jesus is in continuity with Abraham and is in continuity with David. Okay, now, what we'll look at next time, Matthew will show Joseph as the perfect Jew. You will never ever find a more perfect, obedient Jew than Joseph. And the person then that hands to Jesus the lineage of David, going back to Abraham, is the perfect Jew. That's what we'll have fun with next time. Okay, now I'll just rattle off some ways that now Matthew will tie this to the Old Testament and show both that the birth of Jesus is a new creation story and a new story of Israel. Okay. First, the genealogy. Jewish people love numbers. The genealogy is 14 generations, 14 generations, 14 generations. And this is, 7 is a perfect number, 3 is a complete number, so you have 2 times 7, 2 times perfect, multiplied by 3, 3 times 2 times 7. And thereby this means Matthew is saying Israel is now complete, it's time for something new to happen. Okay, that's his first technique. Okay, now he shows how Jesus now is, one reason he's so totally unexpected is that this is a new creation. Now if you look at chapter 2, now chapter 1, verse 18, would someone read just the first sentence?
The birth of Jesus Christ took place in this way.
Okay, now what Raymond Brown tells us that the birth here, or in my Jerusalem Bible, it's came to be born, that the first readers knew this was exactly the same word that was used for the book of Genesis. And so we don't see this, but the early reader would, that what Matthew is saying is, get yourself ready for a new Old Testament. Do you know what I mean? A new Old Testament. The whole thing is starting over. This is a new Genesis. Okay, then there's more evidence that he adds to this. One, the spirit enters or hovers over the void of Mary's womb. And Luke will bring this out even more. But right away here you have a picture of a new creation. In the Genesis story, he's already laid out the word Genesis. In the Genesis story, how in the first creation story, how did God bring creation out of nothing? What hovered? Yeah, the spirit or the wind of God hovered over the void. And now the parallel, now the wind or the spirit or the Holy Spirit hovers over the void of Mary's womb now to bring forth the beginning of a whole new order of reality or a whole new creation. There's other striking parallels. The Genesis begins with two creation stories, one that's very neat and orderly, the other that is a story form. Then Matthew begins with his neat 14, 14, 14, and then he cuts and immediately goes into a story. Very likely he was recreating the mood of the opening of Genesis, where you had the neat 7 days, and then the next story of Yahweh walking in the garden and blowing on the, or bringing the clay out and making the creation of humanity. Now, we've just barely started Matthew, and I won't even get all of them in. Matthew has packed so many. The other way he does it with all his fives. Here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 parts to this story. The gospel in miniature, the first two chapters, are wrapped around 5 Old Testament passages. So you have 5 sections. The entire book of Matthew is divided into 5 sections with very neat divisions between the 5 sections. Why would he be so intent on creating the number of 5 over and over and over again? What was significant about 5? Anybody guess? This is one of those I know the answer to you type of education, which is terrible. Right, 5 books of Moses, the Pentateuch. So he's really saying here, you know, if you have ears to hear, if you have eyes to see, what you are reading is a new Pentateuch. And this gets just exciting when you get into the main part of the book of Matthew, where it's really the new Pentateuch and Jesus is the new Moses.
And all this numerical thing, symbolism, how much did that appeal to the average, how aware was the average Jewish person? I'm not talking about the scholars now, I'm talking about the average Jewish person.
My guess is they loved it. You know, that this was just part of folk knowledge, all of these numbers. Do you think others that have studied, do you think?
Yeah, wasn't it pretty much the style of it? That not only did you organize it, but you had your themes and it was more or less extended
matter, right? I think so, yeah. That'd be my guess. It wasn't just the scholars that knew this, that it was what you knew from, you know, just as kind of folk knowledge. Now, I'll go through the story and just see these striking parallels where Matthew just piles one on top of another to prove to these Christians that are floundering in their faith that what you have here is not a heretical sect, but you have really the beginning of a new Israel and an Israel that is being what Israel is meant to be. In Matthew, Joseph, the obedient dreamer, goes down to Egypt. Does this remind you of any Old Testament story? What?
Yeah.
Okay, remember the story of Joseph, and he's thrown into the well, and he's taken down to Egypt. So now you have two Josephs going down to Egypt. And it's amazing they even have the same name here. Okay, two Josephs. Okay, then the Joseph in Matthew by adoption is the forerunner of Jesus. And then the Joseph in the Old Testament that goes down to Egypt, which great person comes from his line then in Egypt? Who is the greatest figure in the Old Testament? Yeah, Moses. Okay, now so Matthew now has the parallel set up now for his readers, that you have the old Moses and now the new Moses. Okay, then Herod destroys all the male children to try to get rid of the new Moses. Okay, now do you remember any parallel to that in Genesis? Okay, the bulrushes. What we have here now is the old Pharaoh and the new Pharaoh. You know, all Herod is doing is playing a role of the new Egyptian Pharaoh. Okay, the old Pharaoh put Moses, or he ordered all the male Hebrew children of Israel killed. And now what does, in the Matthew story, what does the new Pharaoh do? Wait, somebody say it out loud. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. All the Hebrew children in the surroundings of Bethlehem killed. Okay, Jesus is rescued. You know, there aren't exact parallels here because Moses, of course, is in the bulrushes in his basket, while Jesus, the new Moses, is rescued in a little different way. But then they're both rescued. Okay, then each then is free to do his task when Pharaoh dies. Herod dies, so then Jesus is free to go to Galilee, where his ministry will be. Then the old Pharaoh dies, and that then the Pharaoh that remembered what Moses had done dies, so now that frees Moses to do his task, which was freeing the people of Israel. Okay, from the old Moses, you have the creation of a people. From the new Moses, you have the creation of a people. Jesus goes from Egypt to Galilee, and Galilee was synonymous with the Gentiles, Galilee of the Gentiles. So already we're moving to the inclusion argument. See that Jesus went to the very place. The new Moses now goes to the place of the Gentiles to almost foretell that that is the final result of his mission and ministry, is to include the Gentiles. And then if we go now from the Christmas story on into the rest of the book of Matthew, it just, the parallel doesn't stop here at all. The new Moses, the old Moses went up to the mountain of Sinai and brought the law. The new Moses, Luke has the Sermon on the Mount on a plain. Matthew has the Sermon on the Mount on a hill, and it's very important that Matthew has Jesus on a hill for the Sermon on the Mount, because he is the new Moses. As the old Moses went up the mountain, the new Moses goes up to the mountain. And then what do we have from this, the mountain that Jesus goes up to? Okay, the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, the Transfiguration is later, but especially right now, it's the giving of the new law. You know, as Lutherans, we start to shudder at this point. You know, and this is the book of Matthew that, and then the new Moses then on the new mountain gives the new law to the new obedient people. And then that new Moses turns, and this is where the big surprise comes, the new Moses then turns in a combination of three Old Testament themes that merge on the cross. The new Moses combines with Isaiah's suffering servant and combines with the Davidic Messiah, and that is complete on the cross. From the cross, Jesus goes to the final scene where he claims authority as the Davidic ruler over the entire universe, and then sends his disciples out to baptize and teach a new Israel, a new community, the new law. So that's where I'll quit today. What Matthew would like you to feel is that his argument now is almost more powerful than the argument that the people were receiving from their neighbors and their friends.
don't know, is this exciting?
Well, we're not about a reason to believe that we're in trouble.
Oh, excuse, go ahead.
We have a better reason for believing that we're in trouble.
I'm not sure what you mean. So.
All these numbers and all this symbolism and stuff, all these, I guess what I get from what you say, contrived parallel. We've got to have a better reason than that.
I don't know, what is something about?
My question is along the same line. What do you do with the historicity? Were there these 14 and 14 and 14, or is Matthew making this up?
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Okay, that's that's a really the first question that jumps into our minds. You know, is Matthew making all of this up? Number one, he couldn't make all of this up because everybody knew the story. You know what? You couldn't put anything over on these people. I mean, to say that he was making up stories just to fit into his scheme would be to be saying his readers were a lot dumber than we are. Do you see what I mean? In other words, he's taking material that the early Christian church, the very earliest Christian church knows, and he's systematizing it in a way that answers their questions. Do you see what I mean? Now, we could spend the whole 5 days on all of the problems of historicity, and to me that's probably the best way to avoid letting the living Word of God really come into our lives. That's the best escape.
See, to me the other option would be that this plan that apparently Matthew has discovered, and now we have talked about, is the way that it was, that God is saying there was a Joseph in the Old Testament, and now here's another Joseph. And he's doing similar things. Is that an option?
You mean that God planned that I had an old Joseph, now have a new Joseph, and that's beyond our, we can guess or speculate. That's really beyond our. I guess I'd have to say that'd be entering into the mind of God. All we know is that Matthew looked at these stories that everybody knew, and he systematized them in a way that became a very powerful argument to people that needed pastoral help. You see Matthew at this point as a beautiful pastoral person. What do we need in our lives today with all of the energy crisis and our economy falling apart, except for somebody to kind of put it in perspective from in terms of our faith in God. It's very close to what Matthew was doing. There's the hand.
When I said, how do you know this? I just think I think there's a little bit of faith on which we have to accept the history of the Jewish people, where the analogy slipped into my head that applying it to our day, that if we can remember back in the 60s when Kennedy was assassinated, and then you start getting all these analogies with Lincoln, for instance, they had a secretary named this, and there was this and this and this. And that's, we slipped into this today, although 2,000 years ago, we don't see it as well. But the same kind of thing is going on to sort of keep things real, or to bring out historical facts.
Matthew will pile argument upon argument upon argument, but what is to me is fascinating and very important about the book of Matthew is that really at the cross all of these arguments simply fall apart, and at the cross you have the centurion simply looking at the crucified Jesus and confessing. And it's almost, I think, like Matthew saying, okay, you've heard all the arguments moving up to this point, and you've all heard all the arguments from the outside against Jesus being the Messiah and Son of God. And the only place, finally, can you make up your mind or your decision is when you're standing at the cross. And there you make your choice. So in a way, Matthew is almost saying, I can pile all of these arguments, but finally it's at the suffering Savior on the cross that you make your decision. So it's almost like Paul saying, if I could argue, this is what I would say. Do you understand what it, if you want arguments, I'll give them all, but it's finally the cross where you either say yes or no.
In that sense, Matthew's writing the gospel backwards, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. It's back from the cross.
Right. Where he already was, but at the foot of the cross, but he goes back. Mm-hmm. But you can't forget that that's where you start. He's a believer.
Yeah, in other words, these arguments about parallels mm-hmm. with the Old Testament mm-hmm. in no way are meant to convert anybody. You know, it's their pastoral methods to help people who are already Christians have responded to the word of the cross. They're with questions that they're asking, you know, is Jesus really just a heretic?
But it wasn't only the Jews, too. There were a lot of heresies going around in the area, in Palestine. And it wasn't simply that. There was the beginnings of what we would call all the major heresies that have been since the time of Christ. And so these people were insecure. They needed maybe numbers just to feel secure about what they already believed.
It's important to say they already believed. Mm-hmm. This is pastoral help to believers. Mm-hmm. And we know what that means if any of us have ever sat down as a non-believer and think we can find 7 proofs. Mm-hmm. And just watch them fall apart. And how those proofs to us are just so powerful. And they're powerful to us because we've already received the gift of faith. Mm-hmm. And without the gift of faith, they're dumb.
A Jewish friend of mine became a Christian when she was 18 years old, and before she made the statement to her family of what she was accepting, she knew what the reaction from her parents would be, which was her father had a funeral service for her, and from that day forward she was dead and she was not included in the family in any manner. Before she could go to her family and make a statement, this is what I believe, she had to know, she knew that she was going to be considered to be rejecting her faith and what she had been raised with, and she had to know that Jesus was the fulfillment of the gospel or the Old Testament. And this sort of thing, you know, it may seem frivolous to us, why do you need structure or why do you need proofs, but for her, people in that kind of position is absolutely vital. Because you were considered to be rejecting your people and everything you had been taught, which is a horrible thing for any of us to have to live with. And I know for her it was very hard having Christians around her, but I can imagine what those people at that time were going through, because they were more completely ostracized and they didn't have the community to fall back on that we had.
Yeah. Well, I could. They did. They had the Christian community.
But they were pretty
difficult. Yeah. I wanted to respond one more thing about the question of historicity by just saying they all knew these stories. It's important that I'm not all of a sudden saying all the problems of historicity are solved. You know, because the historicity of Luke and the historicity of Matthew have never been solved. You know, we almost have to say, okay, they're not. You know, Matthew has Jesus in Egypt while Luke has him in Jerusalem. In a way, we'll never solve that. We kind of have to just put that on the shelf for heaven or something.
But now we have a reason for him being in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. A very theological reason for him. And that's important. We focus on that and not worry about it. And if you want to read Matthew Brown, he goes into every little detail of the historical problems and the history of the conflict and the scholars that have tried to solve them. Right?
I think it's just helpful to note that our concern with historicity is a rather modern preoccupation. We're so given to want to know what the literal events were and time and place, whereas that's just not true of many, many cultures. Even some cultures today have not that kind of preoccupation. So when we don't see the literal event at a specific time and place or see two different accounts, we think somebody's making something up. Whereas the point was how does some event in history communicate some truth? Yeah. How does it communicate the message? And it's not, for us it's manipulation, but it's just helpful to see that that's our preoccupation. And for them that's not lack of integrity.
Yeah, it's hard that you almost in studying the scriptures have to kind of saw your skull off. Take your Greek scientific Western brain out, put it on the shelf, and find a Hebrew brain, put it in, put the skull back on the floor.
Are you saying these other cultures will say we may create?
Yeah, you can tell the same story over and over and over again. And it can, as it passes through generations, be addressing a different situation at a different time. And
the bombing of Guernica, is it better to go to a newspaper account that was printed on that day or to go to Picasso's massive painting called Guernica? You know, where do you find more truth? And maybe next, tomorrow morning, I think for our first 10 minutes, I'd like to just very quickly present a very helpful old chart on that we've gotten from Luther on interpreting the Bible. We could just stop there and then go on from there. I think it'd be helpful. Mm-hmm.